We're in the Sermon on the Mount. We've called this the King's Speech. And we've spent a couple weeks on the Beatitudes, even though they kind of roll together, to spend some time separating them out and trying to understand them better. That's where we've been, and we're on the last two, and we'll move on next week. Matthew chapter 5, and you can hold to Joshua 5, and we'll turn there eventually. I'm pumped tonight for this section, so I hope you are. So, in the words of Joker, here we go. Matthew 5. I heard these words on a television show, and I copied them down word for word because I think they fit well. The show began like this. It's hard not to hate people, things, institutions when they break your spirit and they take pleasure in watching you bleed. I love this line. Hate is the only feeling that makes sense. But I know what hate does to a man. It tears him apart and it turns him into something he is not, something he promised he would never be. But sometimes life feels like a delicate balancing act. What I feel slamming up against what I should do. And he ended by saying this: impulsive reactions racing to solutions miles ahead of my own brain. Impulsive reactions racing to solutions miles ahead of my own brain. Hate is the only feeling that makes sense. Interesting. I was sitting with a man for lunch one time, and throughout this meeting, this encounter, out of his mouth came this steady stream of almost violent, intense statements about people who were gay. He found a way to take most things that are happening in the world that are wrong and somehow blame them on the gay community. It was unbelievable after a while as I listened, because the longer I was with him, it was like every single situation had to do with that area. And I was sitting there. I remember after a while, I started to wonder what terrifies him about his own sexuality. Because after a while, I kept listening and I didn't think anymore. I don't know that we're talking about them. I think we're talking about things in your own deepest, darkest struggles that get put on them. Probably all of us know people like that. You may struggle with that yourself. You may know people in your family like that who find this issue, a social issue or a group of people that they pinpoint, and it's like everything else circles around that focal point, and all the problems in the world reside around that issue. And you start to wonder when you hear them talk, is that about their own unresolved issues inside and not so much about that issue? I think you see this in the religious world. I try to fight against this, but I call it radio orthodoxy sometimes. Preachers are those who have been made famous in the Christian world. Maybe they've written a book, or they have a large church or a large following that might be on the radio. They tend to, as all humans struggle, that fame goes to the top, and after a while, some of them feel like they're the Pope, and so that they have to make these declarations and say things and get the following to respond. And you'll find different religious people, it's almost like they have the Heretic of the Week Club on their radio station. And they'll tell you, don't read this article, don't go to this blog, this is happening, stay away from this person. If you read their book, it'll take you to the edge, so don't read them. And it feels like, if you're listening to them, that they're always on a crusade. And I began to ask myself, what is it inside of you that you are trying to push away? You know what I mean? What is going on in your own life that you would need to spend that much time labeling, ostracizing, slandering, pushing away, excluding all these others? Are there shadows and doubts and dark beliefs in their own faith journey? And then they push that on somebody else. Because after a while, you listen to them, you say, I don't think we're talking about them anymore. I think that we're talking about you. I think something's going on inside of you. This is a great image for that. It's actually called projection. Where you take your deepest, darkest, submerged fears and struggles and temptations and failures, and you project that onto someone else. It's easier that way because they are evil, you are good. They are unrighteous, you are righteous. They are heretics, you are the orthodox one. You get it. So that's projecting. We probably all struggle with this to a certain degree. Projecting is taking those things in you that are unresolved, things that in the quiet you might really struggle with and haunt you, and then painting them onto somebody else because that becomes a little bit easier. We're in this section called the Beatitudes, and it's been about, if you've been here, it's been about this counterintuitive, exuberant announcement that God's kingdom has come, it has arrived, it has met you, it has redeemed you, it has forgiven you, it has delivered you. Jesus stands here on a mountain much like Moses did, and he functions in a sense as a new Moses. And he has taken you on a new exodus, but you haven't been released from the taskmasters of Egypt, but you've been released from the taskmasters of sin and death. Jesus, we know throughout his life, will take you into death and lift you up in resurrection and seat you in the lap of the Father. So you are a new creation. And he has established a new covenant. This isn't something external outside of you that you're called to live up to. It's the Spirit inside of you propelling you from the inside out. And so Jesus says of these people who have entered into this kingdom, blessed are you. When God has met you, think of this, in your rightness, but also in your wrongness. When he's met you in your light, but also in your darkness. In your success, but also there in your failures. Yes, he's met you in your strengths, but also in your weaknesses. When that happens, when the kingdom comes, everything changes. Think of that. When Jesus comes and he validates you where you are in all of your nonsense, you can no longer see the world the same way again. You look at the world completely different. So I think what happens, and I found this to be true in my own life, and I've talked to some of you, so I know this is true. After a while, you can no longer find yourself living in the same divisive world where you are the righteous ones and they are the screwed up ones. Why? Because God has met you in your screwed upness. And there's nothing left to push away. There isn't a lot left to project onto somebody else. It's that wonderful verse that we find in 1 John that says, perfect love has arrived and it is cast out fear. So let me give you a different picture of that. The kingdom has come and invaded your space, and it's beginning to eradicate all that fear inside. So now, you can acknowledge, you can own where you fail, where you're weak, and there's no fear. You own it because the fear is gone. It's right there that you're forgiven, accepted, welcomed, invited to the table. There is no fear. That fear evaporates. And in its place is this kingdom kind of life. So why do you say that? Well, then because I don't need to take those things in myself that I see in myself, and then when I encounter them in others and push them away and create my team versus their team, my side and their side. Do you get that? Because right there in my badness, in the mystery that is me, in all my ambiguity and darkness and weakness, I have been met with grace and mercy and released and redeemed and recreated and healed, which means that fear is gone. So that when I meet others, and this is key, I think, for everything else we're going to be say, when I encounter and I'm with others, I realize that there probably is something right in their wrongness. And there's probably some things wrong in my rightness. That's important for you and I because we live in a world of two sides. I think that's a good picture. We live in this context. We swim in the fishbowl where everything is two sides. Now, we're not talking about opinions and perspectives on politics or policies. We're not saying there is no right or wrong. We're talking about people. We're talking about groups of people. We're talking about relationships. And what happens in our world is, are you with them or are you with them? Because we know there's only those two options. Are you with, and this happens within the religious realm, are you with this group of Christians or are you with this group of Christians? Are you for them, which means you're against that? And that's how it works. And we are endlessly handed these two options. And what happens is we take our dark stuff, that fear, that failure, and we paint the other side with it. And Jesus is simply saying something profound happens in the arrival of the kingdom, in the announcement of the kingdom, when the kingdom grabs a hold of you and starts to take root in your life. You now no longer function what I'll describe as a hermeneutic. Hermeneutics is like when you interpret and apply the Bible. Like, what is this context saying? So you now no longer function from a hermeneutic of fear and suspicion. When this person says something or does something or when this author writes something, you don't function out of a hermeneutic of fear and suspicion. You give the benefit of a doubt. Now you function out of a hermeneutic of love. Because the kingdom resides in you. And when that happens, all of a sudden, the world is not that simple. The same old labeling systems don't work quite as well anymore. When you were with this group, you used to say about that group, them. But now you know them and you've encountered them and it's not that easy anymore. It's not that simple. How many of you I know... this to be true, how many of you, the same old debates are just not that interesting anymore? Why? Because your fears are met and embraced in Christ that causes that fear to evaporate, and suddenly it's not about drawing lines in the sand or sides or team. You're not in this against posture, but you're actually now open. You're in this posture of embrace. You're able to accept people as they are because God has met and embraced you where you are. Amen. The question becomes this. Why does Jesus say, blessed are the peacemakers, those who bridge the gap, and he then uses the phrase, children of God? So what is it about peacemaking that connects with children of God? I mean, if you thought that, I mean, so far in the Beatitudes, we've covered this. Blessed are those who poor in spirit. They don't have confidence in themselves. They cast themselves on Jesus, for theirs is the kingdom. Blessed are... Now I'm forgetting because I'm going off my head. Blessed are those who mourn. They see the condition of the world. They will be comforted. Blessed are the meek. Because it's actually them who don't force their agenda on the world. They will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst. As a deer pants for water, for righteousness and for right living, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, because they too will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, because they will see God everywhere. So what is it about blessed are the peacemakers? This is really cool. I'm about dying here to share this with you. But what is it about peacemakers that Jesus connects to children of God? And I'm going to steal my thunder for weeks to come, but that's okay. I'll just cover it again because you will hopefully forget by that time. But Matthew chapter 5, look at verse 43. Matthew 5:43. So we're just a little bit ahead. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. So we could maybe retranslate this and say, you have heard it said, take sides. But I say to you, the one who is on the other side of the sand, the one who is on the other team, the one who sits across the aisle from you, move towards them and wish God's best on them. As you've been blessed, wish God's blessing on them, even enemies. Think of that. If someone stands in opposition against you, they have a different perspective and understanding of you, you move towards them in love and pray God's best. Don't pick sides. Here's why you do it. Next verse. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. I love that phrase that says that you may be children of your Father. Why does he say that? Because God gives, I don't know what's happening there, so you're going to have to mess with that. Something's on the screen. I can't move it. God gives both the sun and the rain to both. Think of that. He sends his love and he gives good things to both sides, the righteous and the unrighteous. So good gifts and love are going out to whatever side of the spectrum they are on. Why? Because that's God's nature. Because God is like that. You see? So instead of participating in a process or a cycle like everybody else that causes division and draws lines in the sand and pushes people away, you have encountered this king and his kingdom in your good and in your bad, and you have been embraced in all your murky depths. And you've been blessed right there in that murkiness. So now you can no longer go around shoving people in their proper boxes and containers and labels. You can't take sides because you begin to see people for how God sees them. You see that line, how important that is, even though that's coming in weeks ahead? He gives good things. Think, in an agricultural, the sun is a good thing, the rain is a good thing, especially in an agricultural society, where your food and your livelihood depend on that. He sends those kind of good gifts to both sides of the spectrum. And so I feel what Jesus is saying, when you embrace and you move across the aisle to both sides of the spectrum, well, then you're like children. You begin to represent your Father. Here's why, like I would need to give you all an explanation for this, but here's why the Bible's important. Look at Joshua chapter 5, because here's what I think in our time and age, it's easy to look at the Bible and especially the Old Testament and say, boy, a lot of this seems so outdated. How does this speak into our time and place? But we need that. We need different people from different times with different agendas and perspective speaking into our way of seeing things. And here's one of those things in the Old Testament that I think could be missed. Joshua chapter 5, look at about verse 13, and here's kind of an image what's represented there. This is awesome. Joshua 5, it says this, verse 13. Now when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and he saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" Did you catch that? That text asks the same question. Are you with us or are you with them? You're either with us or you're either with them. This guy says, neither. Well, wait a minute, that's not an option. We didn't give you choice C. You have choice A or B. Choice C is not an option. See that? Even here in the Old Testament is that human impulse to reduce everything in life down to two options. You're with us or you're not. This man says neither. Then look what he says. Neither, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, "What message does my Lord have for his servant? Are you with us or are you with them?" Neither. A matter of fact, the place that you're standing is holy and sacred. Take your shoes off and have a bigger perspective on life. Have a bigger view of things. Now, how does this speak to us? Now, I'm stealing thunder here, but this this quick thought. If you come at people with hate and venom and anger and choosing sides and suspicion, then I think Jesus would say to them, you're confusing them about what your Father is like. You're confusing the world about what your Father's like. Because as children, get this, you are to expose and reveal the nature of your Father. You are to reveal to people the very nature of your family. And I think in our culture and our time, what people often resist isn't God or the kingdom, but it's our character and picture of the kingdom. And they look at it and they say, that's ugly. I don't want to participate in that. There's enough trouble and debate in my own life. I don't want to then join the religion bandwagon and participate in that, because that picture is not pretty. That's what they resist. So are they resisting the kingdom of God? And I'm not saying if we get this right, then there'll be worldwide revival and everybody will fall on their face. But often, let's be honest, what they resist isn't God. It's a painting, a picture. It's a false picture. Now, not that this makes it easy, because I think the text would go on to say, now, what do you think happens in a world where there's constantly presented to you two options? What do you think happens in a world of divisiveness when that world encounters someone who's trying to bridge the gap? When someone's trying to bring two sides together and they see more than two options, how do you think the world is going to respond? And the next phrase is, blessed are you when you're persecuted. In your, and I think this is a great image, in your peacemaking, I'm having trouble clicking this tonight, but there we go. Now I went too far. In your peacemaking, you often bring conflict. There's the paradox. It's called the friction of peacemaking. So what do you mean? Well, the Jesus way seriously threatens how the world operates. If perfect love casts out fear, do you realize how many people are going to look at you and say, what? We don't operate in fear? How are we going to raise money? How are you going to run a presidential campaign without fear being the heartbeat and pulse? So that if you're operating out of perfect love, which casts out that fear, what? We're not going to be able to raise money for that. See, some people are not ready to hear that. Imagine you're in a conversation with somebody, you're having lunch, and you say, your position there where you just made the other side the demon, I don't think it's that clear. How ready are people to hear that? I know you're convinced of your rightness, but could there be some wrong things in your rightness? Could there be some right things in their wrongness? I mean, who wants to enter that conversation? Just shake your head and let's have a cup of tea and go on our way, because we're friends. Agree with me. Don't enter into that conversation with me. You see that? Jesus comes as the Prince of Peace, but what that causes in many instances is division, conflict, and eventually death. Man, I don't think you can see it on here because that verse is so, but notice Jesus' words. That makes more sense. I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword. You could take that verse very easily out of context, but peacemaking, instead of drawing a line in the sand, when you look not for this way or that way, but a third way, when there's more options than A and B, it will cause conflict. Dead Man Walking was a movie with Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon, pretty popular years ago. Sean Penn has killed these kids, and he's now on death row. And the nun, Susan Sarandon, has been visiting the family of the daughter killed and also spending time with the killer. And the movie moves in such a way that she's visiting the victims and the murderer. And then there is this moment when the parents actually realize that she is visiting the killer of her daughter. Look at this short clip, see if it'll work.
What made you change your mind? Did you? made you come around to ours then?
I wanted to come and see if I could help y'all and pray with you.
I love that line. There's kind of this look of bewilderment and confusion and saying, you know, I'm trying here, but I just want to be like Jesus. And he seems to indicate that people are greater than their worst act. Peacemaking sometimes says, I am on neither side because I'm on both sides. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will become children of God because they reveal the very nature of their Father. Right here in the middle of the sermon, will you stand with me and let us say this prayer so we don't move quickly beyond it? Let's say this prayer of St. Francis together so we understand this line better, and then we'll look at persecution and we'll be done. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O divine master, grant that I might not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love, for it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Amen. I contain some of those paradoxes. You can have a seat. So, if you'll notice now the pattern, those first four Beatitudes show us God's kingdom comes in, God's grace moves in and sets up shop in our neighborhood. He meets us and he blesses us right there in our spiritual poverty, our nothingness, our mourning, our meekness, our desire for and need for his righteousness. He touches our lives. We're transformed by his grace, working with the Holy Spirit from the inside out. When that happens, notice the change, the shift in the Beatitudes, because now you begin to relate to others differently, as highlighted by those next three Beatitudes. You are merciful to others because Christ has been merciful to you. You are pure in heart. You're not crowded. You will one thing. And now you don't take sides against each other. Instead, you're more like a bridge that fills in that gap between. And then that brings us to the last beatitude. Blessed are those who are persecuted. Now, when you see that line, I'm just trying to be honest. When I saw that line at first, if you're living in Indianapolis, which we know is the epicenter for all things progressive culture, and you're living in Indianapolis in 2012, you know that persecution is happening, but let's be honest, it is those people. It's those people far away living in other countries under certain empires and regimes, and they are suffering. And so it sounds like Jesus finishes off here with those who are really heroic and brave souls. The other ones start to make sense when we really hear him and understand him. But this one is like, whoa, Jesus is really talking. Like, he's talking to those fearless ones out there who don't compromise, even if it costs them their life. So I began to think of things like this. You know, you've encountered Voice of the Martyrs. They have a website, they have a magazine where you can read weekly, monthly of pastors who are put in prison, of people who, like some girl, Muslim girls, who don't wear the head covering anymore, and then they're ostracized. I mean, they're not allowed to continue their education. You can constantly read that. You take Christianity Today that comes out every so often, and they will list all these people in different countries who are suffering in very significant ways. So it seems like when I read that one, unless stormtroopers are at your door threatening to throw you in jail, then you're not really following Jesus. You know, you're not really a disciple of Christ. It's like we have to wish I hope persecution comes to America, because then we can be true disciples. I read that and I feel like, well, God blesses, which seems to make sense. He blesses the super Christians. And I don't mean to take away from this, because truly, there are those who are being persecuted, and this is true of them. I believe God would say to them, I am with you. Great is your reward. The blessing of heaven is yours. But maybe, as you and I read that, it's about all persecution. The scholar, I at least like this idea, Edward Schweitzer, he says about this blessing, and I just put that little phrase up, it extols not the strong who, to the admiration of all, heroically defend their faith, but to those who are defamed and go down to ignominious defeat. I know ignominious is a word that you've used all week and earlier today. I say to you, text that one, ignominious. But do you see what he's saying? It encompasses all persecution. So maybe you could think in your mind, all the quiet, subtle, unnamed, unnoticed ways that following Jesus hurts. Whenever following Jesus costs you and you lose out, and you're not praised or you're seen as a hero, you're not put in the news, no one's really honoring that, but it costs you. And I think this one's just really honest, that when you attempt to live in this way of Jesus, when you try to do God's will here on earth as his will is done in heaven, then this blessing simply points out to you, you're going to be met with resistance. Because there are people who are part of a process, they're part of a cycle, and it works for them. It's a cycle of greed and violence, and that's how commercials work, and that's how money is made, and that just becomes the normal air that we breathe. And when you see the way of Christ juxtaposed right next to that, well, that threatens you. But I'd like to suggest here, I don't know if I'm totally accurate on this, but I would like to suggest that maybe these Beatitudes here form somewhat of a loop, because it says about the poor in spirit at the beginning, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It also says at the ending about the persecuted, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. In the Bible, that's called an inclusio. It's like two bookends saying this introduction, this goes together. It's like the bread on a sandwich, and everything else is sandwiched in those thoughts. So it's like parentheses around that introduction. But I would say to you, maybe we're being brought, if you picture a loop, we're being brought full circle. Here's what I mean. So God comes to us where we are. He meets us where we are. He brings his blessing. It's a present reality of happiness and good fortune. Even though you might find yourself in those varying circumstances, you wouldn't normally think of yourself as blessed, but the kingdom is a whole new reality. And he says, no, you're blessed when you find yourself in those circumstances. Because that's the upside down kingdom. This transformed reality invades the hearts and lives of people. And what normally wasn't considered blessed now, because of the kingdom, is blessed. And so how's he start off? Like you would in a 12-step program. You are blessed in your spiritual beggarliness. When you're like a deer panting for water, and you're like someone sitting on the side of the road holding out a cup because you got nothing to offer and you're dependent on them, you're blessed. It begins with complete powerlessness, doesn't it always? Isn't always that the beginning to something else? Notice it also begins, though, in utter grace. And then it moves to mourning and contrition. You look at your condition. You look at the condition of the world. You look at death and suffering and sin. And you say, oh, this wasn't God's intention. And you mourn. You mourn your contribution to that. I mean, you've contributed to that. You're a part of that, the mess that's been made. And do you notice? Look how that flows. It then leads to your powerlessness again, because now he says, you're blessed when you have this humility, this directable, teachable spirit about you, where you're not trying to force your agenda anymore, because you see where that's gotten you. Now you're more humbled, and when you're humble like that, that will create in you this insatiable hunger for justice, for rightness, that God would take everything that is crooked and make it straight, even in your own life. And we looked at the paradox. God fills you, that's the paradox, with hunger, with greater desire, greater levels of desire for deeper levels of intimacy. So he fills you with more hunger. You see, those make sense, don't they? Poverty of spirit, mourning, meekness, all those drive that deep hunger for God. So God meets you in your struggle, in your powerlessness. When you fall to your knees and you have nothing, you're at the end of your rope, you don't even have a wisp of religion, and he says to you, the blessing of the heavens are yours. Now, when you meet others who have bit the dust, who have fallen to their knees, who have failed, who know that fear inside, you have mercy upon them because God has met you not in your successes, but in your failures. God's met you not where you shine bright, but actually in your darkness. And God has extended grace to you, and so now you're able to extend grace to others. You have mercy. Mercy is realizing that if your life is overcrowded and filled, you're empty. And you find when you pour yourself out, that's actually when you're filled. These crazy paradoxes of Scripture. And when you find yourself poured out, then you also realize that your heart is pure. It's not crowded and filled. You're starting to realize in the kingdom, to will one thing is more than many things. And so your food is to do the will of him who sent you. You're like Jesus, and you seek first the kingdom, and then everything else falls into place. So your heart is pure towards God, but also towards others, because it says you see God, and when you see God, you see others differently. So now, see how these flow together? Now you can't have those same old projections where you take sides and you figure out what team you're on and it's us versus them. You can't live in that split anymore because you have a Jesus kind of love. When you do this, you're a peacemaker, you're bridging the gap. And here's what you're going to find. Here's what I mean by a loop. You're going to find that you need a blessing again. The way that you are in the world, your posture, living in the way of Jesus, is going to conflict. I mean, the Jesus way, please take that in all its fullness. The Jesus way seriously threatens how the world operates. So maybe this thing, can you picture that now in your mind? Maybe this is a little bit like a loop, because God meets you in your powerlessness. He meets you in that fear, those dark, murky places, and you're embraced. And so you begin to follow in his way, and you extend that grace that's been extended to you, and it'll be difficult and it will be hard. And now trying to live this way of Jesus and to wash other people's feet, you're going to end back up at the same place, because it's hard. Being Jesus' presence will cost you, and you're going to fall flat on your face, and there's going to be plenty of days that you go, is this worth it? Is telling the truth, is being honest, is going the extra mile, is turning the other cheek, is loving continually when it's continually thrown to the ground and resisted, is it worth it? And you know what? You'll find you're on the ground and you've revisited your powerlessness. And once again, you're poor in spirit. And Jesus says, I will bless you there. Yours is the kingdom. truth always has this way of clashing with the status quo and with the vested patterns of sinful behavior that the world just now assumes, well, these are normal. I mean, this is how human beings live. It'll be hard. It'll be difficult. And Jesus says to you, I will be with you as you walk the way of Jesus. I will be with you more than ever. Look at verse 11. We're almost done here. Look at verse 11 of Matthew 5. I had you turn to a couple places, but Matthew 5, we're back at verse 11. Look at that again. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Persecute has this idea of to pursue. Can you see the word there? Or to prosecute. It's like when somebody has it out for you, they have an issue with you, and they won't drop it, and it seems like everywhere you turn, their face is there. They're accusing you. You can't get away from it. The idea of insult is like, I'm going to try to give you different words so you picture this. It's like reproach or defame. To disparage someone, to rail at them, to assail them with abusive words. In our culture, it's to email someone in all caps. So you read the email and go, oh man, they're really mad. It's in all caps. You know, I'm in trouble now. And then another word for persecution in that next. So you got persecute in verse 10 and verse 11. You have another word there for persecution that means more than just to pursue one. But now that evil, that thing that they have out for you corrupts other people too. So that they have such a problem with you that they actually turn others against you. There's this idea here of a Greek word. It's suedomai. You can see in suedo there the idea of people lying and cheating, defraud. Get the idea of falsify. They make things up. They lie. They attribute things to you that aren't necessarily so. Do you realize that in the early church, at least during the first 3 centuries of church history, so Jesus is rather prophetic here, the early church was accused of cannibalism, incest, atheism, and just general loathing of humanity. Now, these accusations were really gross, distortions of actual Christian practices. So can you picture that? The charge of cannibalism was probably related to the celebration of the Lord's Supper. If you eat my flesh and you drink my blood, then you participate in me. The charge of incest was probably related to the Christian practice of believing couples referring to their spouse as brother or sister. The charge of atheism was related to Christians' rejection of the gods. They didn't believe in the Roman pantheon. Well, you don't believe in the gods. Well, then you don't believe anything. You're an atheist. They charged them with this just general hatred of humanity because that was Christians' refusal to follow society when it participated in these immoral practices. So you can imagine, some of these accusations were probably just not people on the outside kind of confused and misinterpreting Christian practices. They were likely deliberate distortions of the truth designed to defame believers altogether. See? So Jesus has that thought in there. And Jesus is saying in all of that, that you are blessed, and you can picture, can't you see in all those different words that Christ centers around those Beatitudes? Jesus is saying in all of those, you are blessed there. When blessing seems like the last thing, no one would describe you as blessed. When blessing seems like the last thing in your life, I will meet you there more than ever with blessing because I am on your side. Notice he doesn't begin with law. Here's all the things you have to do, even get persecuted, to earn my favor. He starts off with a reminder of grace. Notice that. Blessing before anything else he says. Blessing. He begins off blessing. You know the difference between religion? Religion creates in you a sense of guilt and shame that always has you saying, I should be doing this, I should be doing that, I should be changing the world more, I need to have more devotions, I need to evangelize more, and that's when you know you have religion. The real deal starts with blessing. Religion says, should be. Jesus comes along and says, blessed are the should be's. That don't have even a wisp of religion. That don't get any. Blessed are those. You see, it's not a ladder. You don't look at these virtues and get overwhelmed with the Beatitudes. He says, I've given you my spirit. I've made a new covenant. It's working from the inside out. You're going to be propelled to be living this way. And when you look around the kingdom, you're going to see that these kind of people make up the kingdom. But it isn't some kind of ladder to get God's attention. So when life gets you down, you're starting to wonder if it's worth it. Last verse, verse 12. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in the heaven, because you're in the traditions of the prophets who were actually before you in all of this. That's encouraging. To look at people say, in God's time, in God's space, His realm, the realm of heaven, you're fine. When heaven and earth, who were always made to come together, when they finally connect fully, you're going to be set up. Because when you partner with God, when you cooperate with God to do the right thing in this life, you're going to be okay. And matter of fact, doesn't everybody need to hear this? You're not alone. You're stepping into this royal, magnificent stream of tradition when you suffer for being near me. You're linked with Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Hosea and Habakkuk, these great names from the past. You're with them. So this section ends with, look, when people are out to get you, think of that. When they lie about you, when false accusations are made against you and you persecute, you're being persecuted. Notice, here's a command. You want a command? Here's a command. Just rejoice. And when I first hear that, I mean, literally, I'm not joking with you here. I start to get a little angry. Really? You got to be kidding me. Rejoice? I mean, that to me, something that makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck is religious piousness, where people just kind of say, you know, you've had a loved one die, and they'd say, well, they're in a better place. Yeah, come on. I mean, that doesn't help anybody. That might be true, but that doesn't help. So it's that kind of really, oh, you're going through, well, rejoice in trials, because Jesus, that's what that sounds like. Really? Just rejoice. The word rejoice comes from a word that you know, well, charis. It has that root. And it comes from this root that actually means grace or gift. So can you re-picture this? When life gets difficult and you wonder if it's worth it, remember that life and grace and the kingdom are a gift. It's a gift. This idea of rejoice and be glad, it's more than just joy. It's overjoyed. It's extremely joyful. You want to know what he's getting at? This kind of joy, you knew someone had this kind of overjoy when it was expressed through skipping and jumping and leaping. It would be translated, rejoice and leap much. So let's get this straight. When it is difficult, when everyone seems against you, when you feel like you're all alone, when your own failure to get it right is nipping at your heels, when you've tried to do the right thing, but it was misunderstood, and you're persecuted, in those moments, rejoice because it's all a gift, and leap much because you're not alone. You're actually blessed. And if you set out to follow me and you find yourself in hot water, just rejoice and be glad. They did this to the prophets. What I like about Jesus is that he's honest about what happens to you when you try to follow him. You know what we do in the church? We try to gloss over this idea of suffering and cost when Jesus put it right at the forefront. What we do is we get a professional athlete to become a Christian, or somebody in the limelight who's a Christian, and they have this wonderful testimony that says, man, I was at the lowest of low, I was doing drugs and alcohol, and I've accepted Jesus, and now everything is okay, my batting average is better, and I'm playing my instrument better than ever. And that can't happen for you if you simply trust Jesus. And Jesus says, no, no, you're blessed when you're persecuted. He's honest here about persecution, despair, wanting to give up, poverty of spirit, but his conclusion is, when I have met you there and you've met me there in your lowest, most awful, awkward, dark place, when you're there and you want to give up, I will be with you and I will be there with you till the end. So rejoice and leap much, because you can trust this God. You know, again, do you see what the Beatitudes, because this affects the rest of the sermon. Everything to this point has been announcement, not law. It's been announcement. It's not Jesus coming saying, hey, sit down, everybody. You didn't know it, but this is the way the world really works. No, no, no. The kingdom of heaven has come and intersected with your world, and now everything is different. Everything that you assumed before about God and religion has been skewed and is off. Yeah. And you assume these are blessed, and I tell you these people are blessed, because this kingdom is upside down. Or once you become a part of it, you realize maybe it's right side up. But you're blessed when you're here. And he says right now, in those various circumstances, it's a state of being. You know, we use the Australian phrase, it's good on you. White is your world when you're a peacemaker, when you are persecuted, because this is blessing. This is gracious announcement. And then he gives you one command. He ends with that, and the command is, okay, here's something you got to do. What are you to do? Rejoice and leap much, because this is good news. Could we be, may the dwelling place, may all the churches that preach this kingdom in Indianapolis, may all those who follow the way of Jesus, the next time the media or movies persecutes and makes false accusations and creates a tainted character of you, may you not be quick to respond and pour out venom, but may you be like your Father, who gives good gifts to people on both ends of the spectrums, so that people may never say and get the wrong picture of about your Father, and you will then be children of God. May it be said of all Christians that, of course, if they made fun and falsely accused and persecuted the master, will the student somehow escape? Or is he sending you out as sheep among wolves? Why are we surprised when the Jesus way threatens the way the world thinks? Shouldn't be surprised. Matter of fact, we look and say, we're blessed. When we've done this because of right now. Now, we can do this pious. Well, I'm being persecuted. No, no. When you've done it for righteousness' sake, and Jesus says, because of me. Don't strike back. You're blessed. You're blessed. White is your world. God's favor is on you. The blessings of the heavens are poured out on you. I want to end like this, and I just want to show you, and I'll just be honest, I stole these poses here from a yoga website, but you know, however you can get it done, I wanted you to end with these images in your mind. So I'm an image guy. I like a last image to be emblazed. So we're moving out of the Beatitudes. We're moving to the heart of the Sermon on the Mount. We're looking at now what else Jesus says, and all these Beatitudes go together. And so I want you to picture just for a moment, and then we're done, these postures that I think the Beatitudes call you to. You can picture this first one like this, and I'm going to skip ahead, having trouble with this thing. Here we go. Oh, back one. Oh no, that is right. Sorry. There's the first posture. So picture this. The kind of beginning, let's say inaugural Beatitudes, what's happening there? Jesus is blessing what? Empty people. They don't have a lot of confidence in themselves, in the world's eyes, and probably in their own eyes. They don't measure up. They're failures. They're broken people. So Jesus blessed them. So you're pictured, and these might be really good prayer postures for you in the morning. They're pictured, they're down on the ground, but their hands are up because they are empty. But then if you'll notice, it moves into what we could say these kind of helps beatitude, because Jesus has filled them. He's met them where they are. And so now they're able to take this posture somewhat, maybe with hands more out. They're able to take the blessing that they've been filled at and imitate the one who has met them where they're at. And they're able to meet people where they're at. And so now these are the help beatitudes. And then it ends with this last beatitude, where we could say it's like the hurting beatitude, where Jesus blesses hurt people who have taken the flack for trying to bring Jesus' blessing into a world that is strangely against it. And so what happens is they're powerless, and again, they fall flat on their face, and they have to put their hands up again and receive once again. You know, I would call this, because some of you are really into exercise regimes, this is Jesus' exercise regimen. You know, you can see it almost as a sequence in the Beatitudes. You're empty, you're filled with the grace of the Father who picks you up. All everybody that was down, he picks you up and he fills you, and then he sends you out into the world to be his helpers. And mysteriously, when they don't understand and the Jesus way doesn't work with the ways of the world, you're thrown back down again into need. From whence, again, you will rise up on your feet, you will receive, you will help, and you will fall again. And I would say this is how God works his way into the world. You look at the Beatitudes and say, these are the aerobics of discipleship. A posture of receiving, a posture of then being filled, and when you're filled, you have to pour out, and then a posture of falling once again. And God, in this extremely silly, foolish way, works his way into the world. You are blessed. We are blessed, for God has met us in our failures and in our weak moments, and embraced us and invited us to his table, and said, you are mine, and I will fill you. You will be filled. And all those promises from the future, they come to you ahead of time in the present. So white is your world. Heavenly Father, thank you for these pronouncements of blessing in a culture of two sides. In a culture that only sees A and B options. You come and you bless us in our weakness, in our failures, when there's nothing but to throw ourselves in confidence onto you. You bless us and you bring us to the table and you fill us. You allow us to see you. You allow us in unprecedented intimacy with you. In our human experience, you allow the full presence of God to come in, and you accept us and you fill us and you send us out as your helpers, so we can extend this kingdom, this grace, this mercy. We could be bridge that fill in those gaps. And then we fall because we're among wolves and we get torn and it hurts. And a lot of times we just want to stay in our castles and stay away from it all. But we fall on our face again and we lift our hands once again and we're powerless once again. And you love that, because that's when you're strong and you fill us again. And that's the aerobics of discipleship. May we follow this regimen. May we see once again and restore that Christianity not is so much a religion, but it's this ancient tradition that has been passed on, where a master teacher gathers students and apprentices at his feet and teaches them to play in the way that he does. And so may we live our humanity in the way that you did. May we find great power in washing dirt off the feet of others. May we find great power in love and forgiveness and mercy, and not forcing our agenda, but this kind of humble meekness. May we know the presence of God. May we be blessed even when people don't get it, because your way threatens the way the world works. May we know and experience this blessing, and may we extend this blessing. And so if you will, stand with me for the last time. We've had this same liturgy.